Chapter 2. Thus spake the silent halls of Volusia. The moon had not risen, and the garden was lighted with torches aglow in silver cressets when Kull sat down on the throne before the table of Kanu, ambassador of the Western Isles. At his right hand sat the ancient Pict, as much unlike an emissary of that fierce race as a man could be. Ancient was Kanu, and wise in statecraft grown old in the game. There was no elemental hatred in the eyes that looked at Kull appraisingly. No tribal traditions hindered his judgments. Long associations with the statesmen of the civilized nations had swept away such cobwebs. Not who and what is this man, was the question ever foremost in Kanu's mind, but can I use this man, and how? Tribal prejudices he used only to further his own schemes. And Kull watched Kanu, answering his conversation briefly, wondering if civilization would make of him a thing like the Pict, for Kanu was soft and paunchy. Many years had stridden across the sky rim since Kanu had wielded a sword. True, he was old, but Kull had seen men older than he in the forefront of battle. The Picts were a long-lived race. A beautiful girl stood at Kanu's elbow, refilling his goblet, and she was kept busy. Meanwhile, Kanu kept up a running fire of jests and comments, and Kull, secretly contemptuous of his garrulity, nevertheless missed none of his shrewd humor. At the banquet were Pictish chiefs and statesmen, the latter jovial and easy in their manner, the warriors formally courteous but plainly hampered by their tribal affinities. Yet Kull, with a tinge of envy, was cognizant of the freedom and ease of the affair, as contrasted with like affairs of the Volusian court. Such freedom prevailed in the rude camps of Atlantis. Kull shrugged his shoulders. After all, doubtless Kanu, who had seemed to have forgotten he was a Pict as far as time-hoary custom and prejudice went, was right, and he, Kull, would better become a Volusian in mind as well as in name. At last, when the moon had reached her zenith, Kanu, having eaten and drunk as much as any three men there, leaned back upon his divan with a comfortable sigh and said,
"Now, get you gone, friends, for the king and I would converse on such matters as concern not children. Yes, you too, my pretty, yet first let me kiss those ruby lips. So, now, dance away, my rose bloom."
Kanu's eyes twinkled above his white beard as he surveyed Kull, who sat erect, grim, and uncompromising.
"You are thinking, Kull," said the old statesman suddenly, "that Kanu is a useless old reprobate, fit for nothing except to guzzle wine and kiss wenches."
In fact, this remark was so much in line with his actual thoughts and so plainly put that Kull was rather startled, though he gave no sign. Kanu gurgled, and his paunch shook with mirth.
"Wine is red, and women are soft," he remarked tolerantly. "But, ha-ha, think not old Kanu allows either to interfere with business."
Again he laughed, and Kull moved restlessly. This seemed much like being made sport of, and the king's scintillating eyes began to glow with a feline light.
"Aye," said Kanu equably, "it takes an old head to stand strong drink. I am growing old, Kull, so why should you young men begrudge me such pleasures as we oldsters must find? Ah, me, I grow ancient and withered, friendless and cheerless."
But his looks and expression failed far of bearing out his words. His rubicund countenance fairly glowed, and his eyes sparkled so that his white beard seemed incongruous. Indeed, he looked remarkably elfin, reflected Kull, who felt vaguely resentful. The old scoundrel had lost all the primitive virtues of his race and of Kull's race, yet he seemed more pleased in his aged days than otherwise.
"Hark ye, Kull," said Kanu, raising an admonitory finger. "'Tis a chancy thing to laud a young man, yet I must speak my true thoughts to gain your confidence."
"If you think to gain it by flattery—"
"Tush! Who spoke of flattery? I flatter only to discard."
There was a keen sparkle in Kanu's eyes, a cold glimmer that did not match his lazy smile. He knew men, and he knew that to gain his end he must smite straight with this tigerish barbarian, who, like a wolf scenting a snare, would scent out unerringly any falseness in the skein of his word-web.
"You have power, Kull," said he, choosing his words with more care than he did in the council-rooms of the nation, "to make yourself mightiest of all kings and restore some of the lost glories of Volusia. So I care little for Volusia, though the women and wine be excellent, save for the fact that the stronger Volusia is, the stronger the Pict nation. More, with an Atlantean on the throne, eventually Atlantis will become united.
Kull laughed in harsh mockery. Kanu had touched an old wound.
Atlantis made my name accursed when I went to seek fame and fortune among the cities of the world. They are age-old foes of the Seven Empires, greater foes of the allies of the Empires, as you should know.
Kanu tugged his beard and smiled enigmatically.
Nay, nay, let it pass, but I know whereof I speak, and then warfare will cease, wherein there is no gain. I see a world of peace and prosperity, man loving his fellow man, the good supreme. All this you can accomplish, if you live.
Ha!
Kull's lean hand closed on his hilt and he half rose, with a sudden movement of such dynamic speed that Kanu, who fancied men as some men fancy blooded horses, felt his old blood leap with a sudden thrill. Valka, what a warrior! Nerves and sinews of steel and fire bound together with the perfect coordination, the fighting instinct, that makes the terrible warrior. But none of Kanu's enthusiasm showed in his mildly sarcastic tone.
Tush, be seated. Look about you. The gardens are empty, the seats empty, save for ourselves. You fear not me.
Kull sat back, gazing about him warily.
There speaks the savage, mused Kanu. Think you if I planned treachery I would enact it here, where suspicion would be sure to fall upon me? Tut, you young tribesmen have much to learn. There were my chiefs who were not at ease because you were born among the hills of Atlantis, and you despise me in your secret mind because I am a Pict. Tush, I see you as Kull, king of Volusia, not as Kull the reckless Atlantean, leader of the raiders who harried the Western Isles. So you should see in me not a Pict, but an international man, a figure of the world. Now to that figure, hark. If you were slain tomorrow, who would be king?
Kanub, Baron of Blal.
Even so, I object to Kanub for many reasons, yet most of all for the fact that he is but a figurehead.
How so? He was my greatest opponent, but I did not know that he championed any cause but his own.
The knight can hear, answered Kanu obliquely. There are worlds within worlds, but you may trust me, and you may trust Brule, the spear-slayer.
He drew from his robes a bracelet of gold, representing a winged dragon coiled thrice, with three horns of ruby on the head.
Examine it closely. Brule will wear it on his arm when he comes to you tomorrow night, so that you may know him. Trust Brule as you trust yourself, and do what he tells you to. And in proof of trust, look ye.
And with the speed of a striking hawk, the ancient snatched something from his robes, something that flung a weird green light over them, and which he replaced in an instant.
"The stolen gem!" exclaimed Kull, recoiling. "The green jewel from the Temple of the Serpent! Valka, you! And why do you show it to me?"
"To save your life, to prove my trust. If I betray your trust, deal with me likewise. You hold my life in your hand. Now, I could not be false to you if I would, for a word from you would be my doom."
Yet for all his words, the old scoundrel beamed merrily and seemed vastly pleased with himself.
"But why do you give me this hold over you?" asked Kull, becoming more bewildered each second.
"As I told you, now you see that I do not intend to deal you false, and tomorrow night, when Brule comes to you, you will follow his advice without fear of treachery. Enough. An escort waits outside to ride to the palace with you, lord."
Kull rose.
"But you have told me nothing."
"Tush, how impatient are youths."
Kanu looked more like a mischievous elf than ever.
"Go you and dream of thrones and power and kingdoms, while I dream of wine and soft women and roses. And fortune ride with you, King Kull."
As he left the garden, Kull glanced back to see Kanu still reclining lazily in his seat, a merry ancient, beaming on all the world with jovial fellowship. A mounted warrior waited for the king just without the garden, and Kull was slightly surprised to see that it was the same that had brought Kanu's invitation. No word was spoken as Kull swung into the saddle, nor as they clattered along the empty streets. The color and gaiety of the day had given way to the eerie stillness of night. The city's antiquity was more than ever apparent beneath the bent silver moon. The huge pillars of the mansions and palaces towered up into the stars. The broad stairways, silent and deserted, seemed to climb endlessly until they vanished in the shadowy darkness of the upper realms. Stairs to the stars, thought Ko, his imaginative mind inspired by the weird grandeur of the scene. Clang, clang, clang sounded the silver hoofs on the broad moon-flooded streets, but otherwise there was no sound. The age of the city, its incredible antiquity, was almost oppressive to the king. It was as if the great silent buildings laughed at him noiselessly with unguessed mockery. And what secrets did they hold? You are young, said the palaces and the temples and the shrines, but we are old. The world was wild with youth when we were reared. You and your tribe shall pass, but we are invincible, indestructible. We towered above a strange world ere Atlantis and Lemuria rose from the sea. We shall reign when the green waters sigh for many a restless fathom above the spires of Lemuria and the hills of Atlantis, and when the isles of the western men are the mountains of a strange new land. How many kings have we watched ride down these streets before Kull of Atlantis was even a dream in the mind of Ka, bird of creation? Ride on, Kull of Atlantis. Greater shall follow you. Greater came before you. They are dust. They are forgotten. We stand. We know. We are. Ride, ride on, Kull of Atlantis. Kull the king. Kull the fool. And it seemed to Kull that the clashing hoofs took up the silent refrain to beat it into the night with hollow re-echoing mockery. Kull the king. Kull the fool. Glow, moon, you light a king's way. Gleam, stars, you are the torches in the train of an emperor. And clang, silver-shod hoofs, you herald that Kull rides through Volusia. Ho, awake, Volusia, it is Kull that rides, Kull the king. We have known many kings, said the silent halls of Volusia. And so in a brooding mood, Kull came to the palace, where his bodyguard, men of the Red Slayers, came in to take the rein of the great stallion and escort Kull to his rest. There the Pict, still sullenly speechless, wheeled his steed with a savage wrench of the rein and fled away into the dark like a phantom. Kull's heightened imagination pictured him speeding through the silent streets like a goblin out of the Elder World. There was no sleep for Kull that night, for it was nearly dawn, and he spent the rest of the night hours pacing the throne room and pondering over what had passed. Kanu had told him nothing, yet he had put himself in Kull's complete power. At what had he hinted when he said that the Baron of Blaal was naught but a figurehead? And who was this Brule who was to come to him by night, wearing the mystic armlet of the dragon? And why? Above all, why had Kanu shown him the green gem of terror, stolen long ago from the Temple of the Serpent, for which the world would rock in wars were it known to the weird and terrible keepers of that temple, and from whose vengeance not even Kanu's ferocious tribesmen might be able to save him? But Kanu knew he was safe, reflected Kull, for the statesman was too shrewd to expose himself to risk without profit. But was it to throw the king off his guard and pave the way to treachery? Would Kanu dare let him live now? Kull shrugged his shoulders.